This week, we have a nice reminder to play nice on social media. Then, we read a two-part series by Elaine Polonius Pellin about Renaissance and Enlightenment artworks, their symbolism, and what can be gained by a practice of visual dissection. Lastly, we will round out the episode as we take a look at a sort of physical and spiritual equilibrium. What will the cards reveal? Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 564. I want to thank our contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners for making this program possible for over 10 years. That's right, over 560 episodes are available to you right now, all for free, thanks to them. If you're curious on how to support the WCY podcast, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and see how you can help. Additional options are, of course, the shop as well as the bookstore, which contains links to books by people who have been on the show, personal recommended reading lists, and more, all through Amazon affiliates. In the news, I just wanted to let you all know that if you're listening to this on Sunday night or Monday morning, you might still have a chance to catch a presentation that I'm doing for Liberty Lodge in Liberty, Missouri, on Monday night. That is the 26th, the home of illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison, hoping to see him tomorrow evening as well. Of course, I'm recording this on Sunday, hence my reference to tomorrow evening. My thanks goes out to worship brother Rod Guzman, who I believe is now right worshipful, if I'm not mistaken, but really looking forward to that. The first piece I have for you this week was one that was just published last Friday, and it's super quick, super short, but I wanted to throw it in as kind of a bonus. It comes from the Midnight Freemasons, and is always relevant as anything, really, and it comes from illustrious brother Todd E. Creason, who is the founder of the Midnight Freemasons. And it's called A Friday Thought. I ran across this stunning image a couple of weeks ago, somewhere on social media. I couldn't have said it any better myself. In fact, I have said this a few times on here, this blog, but not as well. Like it or not, when we represent ourselves as Freemasons, we represent the entire fraternity. The blog post has an image, a minute book on a pedestal, and above the minute book is a framed 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper that says, "Take a good look at yourself. You're somebody's impression of Masonry." Back to the piece. I used to say that Freemasonry's best advertising was its members. In the social media age, I think that's working against us at times. Let's remember who we are and what we represent, and when we interact with the world. Let's try to remember that when we represent ourselves as Freemasons to the world with a ring, a hat, a bumper sticker, or more especially, on social media, each of us represents all of us. Social media has made the world a much smaller place. Always remember, for better or worse, you're somebody's impression of Freemasonry, just like the sign says. Todd E. Creason, founder of the Midnight Freemasons. I liked this little reminder. I think we need these reminders at times. I think these are trying times for all folk. People are struggling so many different ways, while others, the tides have kind of shifted. Some people who had solid jobs have moved away from solid jobs, and some people who have had not a great career have suddenly found themselves able to make that down payment on a house or something. And all of this kind of shifting of tides has increased the amount of dialogue about the changing times, which can become polarizing over time. And of course, we tend to air our great feelings and our misgivings on social media. And if we are representing the fraternity, it behooves us to be on the right side of history. And the right side is the side that shows that we are good people, concerned with people and the world at large, and making it a better place for everyone. So take that into consideration. I know I will. Took this as a great little reminder. Next up is a two-part series that I found on the Universal Freemasonry blog. So if you go to blog universalfreemasonry.wordpress.com, there are a number of great articles there I know I have linked to them in the past. Last week, we read a great piece from this same blog about the Flaming Sword that was put together by Christine, who is a great friend, colleague, and amazing resource for Masonic knowledge. This week, I've got a two-parter, as I said, which is done by Elaine Paulionis Pellin, and we are going to go ahead and dive into this really cool thing. I was never like the major fan of art. Art is in various types of postmodern art and all of these things when you go to like an art museum. But I have always been attracted to Renaissance and classical art, Enlightenment era art. And this is because I grew up part of my youth in Italy. My dad was in the service. We lived in Naples. We lived off base. We went on frequent trips and went to all these museums. It just really awesome cultural experience. And I will always be thankful for that. But it got me so interested in symbology and things. And it's one of the reasons why I got into Freemasonry, actually. And I found this topic to be curious and inviting and fun. So if you like Dan Brown, you know, you're walking around in these old churches and you see the painting on the wall and it's pointing towards something, to the next clue, and these kinds of things. There is a lot of really interesting esoteric and philosophical content contained within art. In fact, you could argue that it's all esoteric and philosophical content. It's not always just sharing the image that you're seeing or painting. You're symbolically representing some really important and deep meaning things. And so this post was put up on March 18th, 2021, What Esoteric Knowledge Lies Veiled in Classical Art, Part 1. An enduring cornerstone of Western civilization, classical art builds on the cultural ideals of ancient Greece and Rome, as demonstrated in painting, sculpture, and architecture. Founded upon the virtues of harmony and divine proportion, these artists sought to elevate the human form by adorning it with the highest, illuminating humanity's evolution and depicting man's relationship with the divine. For more than a millennia, classical artistic expression has been shaped by the reverence of the virtuous, the good, and the beautiful. In Manly P. Hall's work, The Secret Teachings of All Ages, we learn that, quote, symbolism is the language of the mysteries. In fact, it is the language not only of mysticism and philosophy, but all of nature. For every law and power active in universal procedure is manifested to the limited sense perceptions of man through the medium of symbol. By symbols, men have ever sought to communicate to each other those thoughts which transcend the limitations of language. End quote. Manly P. Hall. Does symbolism transcend the limitations of language? Is a picture worth a thousand words? Cryptic? Abstruse? Mysterious? What does esoteric really mean? The term esoteric has been defined as known only to a few and is derived from the Greek root eso meaning within. To study esotericism often requires communing with a small inner circle of learned fellows in order to embark on a journey of self-discovery. The opposite of esoteric is exoteric, meaning suitable to be imparted to the public, and historically linked to the ancient philosopher Aristotle. Those deemed worthy to attend Aristotle's private discussions were known as his esoterics or confidants, whereas the exoterics were individuals who only attended Aristotle's popular evening lectures. Because such information is largely incomprehensible to the general population, esoteric is sometimes erroneously equated with that which is difficult to understand. Instead, esoteric scholars are typically empowered by exceptional methods of education, such as hyper-specialized training, private tutoring, intensive study, or initiation. Most religions provide exoteric or fundamental teachings as well as a path of esoteric study for those who seek it. Perhaps it could be said that once a fundamental understanding of the tenets of a religion is obtained, a door swings open, providing the seeker a deeper level of wisdom and understanding. In Christianity, the Apostle Paul wrote, quote, "And I, brethren, could not speak unto you as unto spiritual, but as unto carnal, even as unto babes in Christ. I have fed you with milk and not with meat, for hitherto ye were not able to bear it, neither yet now are ye able." End quote. 1 Corinthians 3:1-2. This dichotomy of basic advanced study exists within other religions such as Islam, where Sufism serves as the esoteric branch of the religion. Freemasonry provides similar esoteric instruction to members of all religious faiths. What is the difference between exoteric and esoteric knowledge? Does one need to be an initiate to study esotericism? What lies hidden? Viewing art through an esoteric lens. In this series, we seek to uncover the hidden meaning found in the artistic works of numerous masters, including Michelangelo, Peter Bruegel the Elder, William Blake, George de la Tour, and Raphael. Let us begin the discussion by outlining a basic structure for analyzing art through an esoteric lens. Thereby, we will utilize both observation and intuition, symbolically represented by the concrete and abstract minds. Observation. Observe the work of art and search for the following: inconsistencies, patterns, and clues. Intuition. What does your intuition tell us about this art? Many people think of intuition as instinctual or even magical. Our intuitive hunches, however, are assumptions formed based on experience and cumulative knowledge. They tend to arise holistically and quickly without conscious awareness of the underlying mental process of information. Intuition is non-conscious thinking, essentially the brain on autopilot. Scientists have repeatedly demonstrated how information can register on the brain without conscious awareness and positively influence decision-making. How are observation and intuition different? Does each correspond to a different hemisphere of the brain? The Creation of Adam by Michelangelo. To begin, The Creation of Adam has long been recognized as one of the world's great art treasures. From 1508 to 1512, the Italian Renaissance master Michelangelo Buonarroti painted glorious frescoes, including the Creation of Adam, on the ceiling of the Vatican's Sistine Chapel, as commissioned by Pope Julius II. Michelangelo wrote the following, describing the artistic process. Quote, "After the divine part has well conceived, man's face and gesture, soon both mind and hand, with a cheap model first at their command, give life to stone, but this is not achieved. By skill in painting, too, this is perceived. Only after the intellect has planned the best and highest can the ready hand take up the brush and try all things received." Michelangelo. What can be unveiled regarding the creation of Adam through observation and intuition? To be continued in Part 2. Part 2. What esoteric knowledge lies veiled in classical art? Posted on the 24th of June, 2021 by Elaine Polyanus Pellin. As discussed in Part 1, classical art builds on the cultural ideals of ancient Greece and Rome, as demonstrated in painting, sculpture, and architecture. Founded upon the virtues of harmony and divine proportion, these artists sought to elevate the human form by adorning it with its highest, illuminating humanity's evolution and depicting man's relationship with the divine. Moreover, the term esoteric has been defined as known only to a few and is derived from the Greek root eso, meaning within. To study esotericism often requires communing with a small inner circle of learned fellows in order to embark on a journey of self-discovery. We continue the discussion by considering the following pieces of classical art. Magdalene with the Smoking Flame by George de la Tour. Born in 1593, George de la Tour was a painter mostly of candlelit subjects. La Tour became a master painter and eventually settled in Lunéville, modern-day France. La Tour's paintings are marked by a startling geometric simplification of the human form and by the depiction of interior scenes, lit only by the glare of candles or torches. His religious paintings, done in this manner, have a monumental simplicity and a stillness that expresses both contemplative quiet and wonder. Magdalene, with the Smoking Flame, is a 1640s oil-on-canvas depiction of Mary Magdalene by the French Baroque painter. Melancholia by Albrecht Dürer. Melancholia is one of the large prints known as the German master Albrecht Dürer's master engravings. Created in 1513 and 1514, Melancholia I, a depiction of the intellectual situation of the artist, and is thus, by extension, a spiritual self-portrait of Dürer. In medieval philosophy, each individual was thought to be dominated by one of the four humors. Melancholy, associated with black gall, was the least desirable of the four, and melancholics were considered the most likely to succumb to insanity. Renaissance thought, however, also linked melancholy with creative genius. Thus, at the same time that this idea changed the status of this humor. It made the self-conscious artist aware that his gift came with terrible risks. The Ancient of Days by William Blake. Serving as the frontispiece to Blake's book Europe, A Prophecy, 1794, The Ancient of Days illustrates Urizen, a mythological figure created by the poet. Representing the rule of reason and law, Urizen was Blake's depiction of God as described in the Book of Proverbs, the one who, quote-unquote, sets a compass upon the face of the earth. Viewed an old man with a white beard and hair, Urizen is in an illuminated orb and surrounded by a circle of clouds. There God crouches, his left hand extends a golden compass over the darkness below, creating and containing the universe. With classic anatomy and an energetic, bold composition, Blake's work evokes a vision of the divine creation. The Book of Urizen, lines 31 through 40. Urizen makes the following statement, quote, "Lo, I unfold my darkness, and on this rock place with a strong hand, the book of eternal brass, written in my solitude. One command, one joy, one desire, one curse, one weight, one measure, one king, one God, one law." End quote. William Blake. The Tower of Babel by Peter Bruegel the Elder. Peter Bruegel the Elder, a.k.a. Peter Bruegel, the first, 1525 to 1569, brought a humanizing spirit to traditional subjects and boldly created new ones. He was an astonishingly inventive artist, whose impact was widespread and long-lasting. The Tower of Babel was the subject of three paintings by Peter Bruegel the Elder. The Great Tower of Babel has a group in the foreground, with a main figure thought to be the tower's creator, Nimrod. The painting depicts the construction of the Tower of Babel, which, according to the Book of Genesis, chapter 11, verse 4, was built by a unified humanity which spoke a single language as a mark of achievement built to prevent humanity's scattering. Quote, "Then they said, come let us build ourselves a city, and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, otherwise we shall be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth." End quote. Book of Genesis, chapter 11, verse 4. The School of Athens by Raphael. Master artist of the Italian Renaissance, Raphael Sanzio achieved success and rose to fame early in life. In his 20s, he was invited by the Pope to live in Rome as an artist, where he would spend the rest of his days. Starting in 1509, he began decorating the first of four rooms in the Papal Palace. Raphael's fresco, The School of Athens, has come to symbolize the marriage of art, philosophy, and science that was a hallmark of the Italian Renaissance. Painted between 1509 and 1511, it is located in the first of the four rooms designed by Raphael, the Stanza della Signatura. The School of Athens is considered a powerful and prophetic work of art, illustrating the evolution of consciousness, the role of Christ and Christianity in human evolution, and the path of the individual inner development. Spadaro shows how Raphael's paintings depict, with precision and in detail, the spiritual, cosmic, and physical situation of humanity, through which it must grow to fulfillment. Is Freemasonry's great work both esoteric and exoteric? Quote, "Of interest, exoterically, is the fact that the soul passes through experiences before, during, and after initiation into Freemasonry, which are symbolically portrayed within the temple. The application for membership, interviews, voting, acceptance, payment of dues, preparation, admission, initiation, these represent, at the physical level, precisely the same process through which the soul has gone, or will go, at the causal level." End quote. Brother Jeffrey Hodson. Described by some as a fraternal group, an esoteric organization, a charity, a cult, or a religion, what exactly is Freemasonry? Regardless of how it is labeled, Masonry's goals and missions remain constant. Masons work to create a better world by improving humanity, both at an individual and collective level. Quote, "Remember always that all Masonry is work," wrote Brother Albert Pike, "and Masons are sculpted by ritual for exoteric labors, activities conducted for the welfare of mankind according to Masonic principles. It is in this mysterious hidden ritualistic work where much of the speculation of what Masonry does and does not do begins," as Brother Christine Wilson Slack, 33rd Degree, writes. Quote, "In at least one Masonic order, and probably many others, it is specifically stated that Freemasons have a special charter to input esoteric knowledge into the Masonic members. By esoteric, let's use the basic form of the word, meaning knowledge meant only for a few. Freemasonry, being a select organization, is esoteric in this way. Masons constitute a minute percentage of the approximate 8 billion human beings currently alive on our planet. Esoteric, in its uncomplicated form, does not connote anything spiritual, religious, or occult. While some aspects of Freemasonry may be considered esoteric, other important work is actually esoteric in nature. According to the Masonic scholar and author Jeffrey Hodson, quote, "A great work, therefore, remains to be done for exoteric Freemasonry. It is essential that it be reoriented toward its true purpose, which is both to aid the spiritual evolution of mankind and to establish brotherhood of mankind, and to establish brotherhood without distinction of race, creed, sex, or color on earth. It is greatly to be desired that the order be revealed as a recognizable expression of and channel for the true wisdom." Jeffrey Hodson. It is toward the fulfillment of these goals that Brothers of Universal Co-Masonry labor. Whether aware or unaware, all members assist in these endeavors and bring humanity step by step ever closer to its ideal and perfect state. Now, I found the article to be, this two-part series, to be a really great exploration of pieces of art, and obviously we're going to link this article so that you can check out these images. They are linked within the article. You'll see them, you can click on them, and they get bigger and all of that kind of thing. But specifically, while you look at these pieces of art, it may behoove you to pull out your notebook and write down things that you notice. Because there are things in these artworks that are very symbolic that may speak to you in very interesting ways. I think if you go to the website, you click on it, the first piece that's up, it doesn't actually have a descriptor of the piece of art that's on the top of the article, but it is one of my favorites, actually. It is wonderfully laden with all of the symbolism you could ever want. And certainly you can spend hours dissecting it, and people have. So before we wrap up this week, I want to go ahead and look at this new deck I bought. It's a Halloween Oracle. I will probably review it on the Wizard of Arge over on the TikTok, but I'm going to open it right now. So in the past, we've done these segments where we're talking about talking about the tarot and how tarot can assist us in looking at an image and subsequently looking at what it means and then seeing how that applies to our life and using it like a tool, not unlike the 24-inch gauge or the common gavel, all of these other Masonic tools that we look at and how we ask, how does that apply to our life right now? In the same way, tarot takes an image that we can look at and see all the symbolism that it contains, gain some things through intuition, and then ask about the scenario that it has and ask ourselves, does that pertain to us right now? And oftentimes they do. And the reason why is because we as humans don't ever really want to look at things in ways that are different from how we normally look at them. So tarot forces us to look at things from a different point of view, one that we might never have come to. So in that, it is very special. So, what is the difference? We've talked about the difference between an oracle deck and a tarot deck. Tarot deck is 78 cards and is always 78 cards and is very rigid in its interpretations and explanations for each card. An oracle deck can essentially be anyone's interpretation of any kind of symbolism and what they think it might mean with a particular set of cards that they have designed. Now, a set of cards could be anywhere from 2 cards to 500 cards. There's no rules when it comes to oracle decks. So with the oracle deck, it's more of an artist's interpretation and their own exploration of what that could mean for somebody. And I'd like to use one right now and see. It's all based on Halloween, because we're coming up to Halloween. We all know Halloween's around the corner. If you don't know, it's my favorite holiday right after September 1 hits, and then it's Halloween season until November 1, and then it's Christmas season. So on November 1st, I put up my Christmas tree. Boom. I don't even go into Thanksgiving. So we have a good time here at the Johnson House. Anyway, let me go ahead and give these a little bit of a shuffle. Some really cool artwork on these cards. Very Halloween that you would imagine. There's no particular way that I'm shuffling these or drawing them or charging the deck. I literally just opened them, so I'm getting my first look as I talk to you right now and recording it in one take. just going to kind of fan these things out in front of me. And I think I'm just going to pick one card. They don't fan out very well because they're new, so they're kind of sticking together a little bit. But let's see. I think I'm going to grab this card. It looks like it's trying to hide a little bit. So if it's trying to hide, maybe it's that's the card we want. I don't know. Let's find out. All right, I'm going to flip this guy over. What did I get? Ooh, I got the werewolf. It says exploring wildness. Interesting. So Oracle decks always will come with a book that the author has put together. And let's read what the author says about the werewolf. And maybe we'll find some interesting correlation between the symbolism contained there and something that we might be going through in our personal lives. Ah, here we go. So the werewolf has a brief entry here. It says, exploring wildness, lumosity triggers it, a wild moon rises, pain in blood, and fangs, fur and howling and wolven guises. After a painful, excruciating, bone-jarring struggle against the change, the man releases to the magic, howling unrestrained under the full moon. Now the half-man, half-wolf rises up, snarling and goes looking for blood. Yes, we all know the power of a werewolf. After the end of the European witch trials, an intense interest in the werewolf developed in folklore and evolved to become the stuff of horror movies. Fairly constantly since then, the wolfman, or lycan, has featured regularly in tales both oral and written. Of course, during the last 100 years, there have been many hugely popular movies, including American Werewolf in London, and themes in books such as the Twilight Saga series. The werewolf is a kind of shapeshifter, but one that has traditionally had little control over his wildness. In a way, an inner battle between civilization and wild animal nature fights inside the one body. The vitality, strength, and freedom of the animal versus the reason, control, and intellect of the man. Which one, though, is the dominant force? What is the healthy balance between animal nature, one that is wild, free, connected to nature, and our radically civilized humanness, separate from or dominant over nature? The werewolf asks us to consider, now this is the calling of the card here, this balance, and to delve into our own ideas of wildness, independence, and custodianship of the planet. When is the last time we spent all day outside? When is the last time you threw your head back and howled at the moon? Do you quash the vitality and curiosity of your body and mind by sitting all day in front of a computer? The werewolf challenges you to weave a balance between nature and your own nature. Aha! This is a very interesting card and something that I find absolutely relevant to my life today. I usually go for a walk every single day outside. I have not done this in months. Why? Because I've been really busy with computer work. Sounds like I need to howl at the moon a bit. I guess I need to get outside. Spend some time in the wilderness. And I think this speaks to equilibrium, this idea that we have in all things in masonry. We go down the path of mysticism and esoteric knowledge, and we come to this kind of crossroads of a sorts that says, hey, there is no such thing as dualism. It's all just one thing. But we as humans kind of compartmentalize things in two separate camps and then further delineate them into smaller and smaller subcontexts and study those things. And we kind of get lost from that top oneness. But it will benefit us essentially to recognize the duality of certain things, at least for us, even if there isn't really a duality, but it helps us recognize a balance in our lives. And certainly, could this be relevant to the ideas contained in the four cardinal virtues? Temperance? Sure. The idea of balancing one's wishes and desires with what's best for their community, themselves, their family. And certainly this card will remind me to get outside a little bit. So that's it for this week. I hope to see you tomorrow evening at Liberty Lodge, and after that, I will be, of course, at the Grand Lodge Sessions, Springfield, Illinois, where I'm going to be attending many different things, one of which is something very near and dear to me, which is the Illinois Lodge of Research, where we are hosting a great talk by illustrious brother Brian L. Pettis. He's a past emeritus contributor to the Midnight Freemason blog, an all-around awesome dude. So I really hope you guys come out to that. It'll be at 3 o'clock in Plaza Room 3, the Wyndham Center. Hope to see you guys around. And with that, that's it. We'll talk to you all next week. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
That's it. Here's your